Ian Fleming is the author of the famous novels that feature 007, otherwise known as Bond, James Bond. I can't make my voice that low, but that's okay. And I don't have that British accent either. That makes it kind of that much. But there's been five actors that have portrayed this famous character on the big screen movie productions. And their numbers are after their name. They're how many different movies they had as that character. But as I thought about James Bond this last week, I thought about a man who was a man of action. This was a super spy who never sat still. You see him not sitting behind a desk or researching things like some spies do nowadays, but he is a man who cuts to the chase. He's always on the move, going from one event to another and trying to keep things going. And he is a man that tried to keep his identity under wraps. A man who kept who he truly was and what he was truly trying to do hidden away. And of course, with some of his crazy gadgets that he had, provided by Q, he did things that were almost miraculous in our sight. Now think back 2,000 years to another James Bond type of character. You see, 2,000 years ago, there was another man of action, a man who wasn't content sitting still, who was cut to the chase, who moved from one place to another, going from one event to another. He, too, tried to keep his identity under wraps so that he could work more efficiently. And he, too, worked miracles, although not with the gadgets. He actually did miracles without fancy technology. You see, Jesus was a man of action. And we're going to take a look at the book of Mark. We're going to start a new series this week on the book of Mark. And we're going to look how action-packed this book of Mark is. And by the end of this first chapter that we'll look at this morning, we'll see three lessons that we can learn from the book of Mark in this action-packed chapter. So let's take a look, first of all, at who wrote this book. It's titled Mark, but it actually was written by someone called John Mark. Probably John Mark, according to all the church history that we know of. And we know a lot about the person John Mark. He's mentioned several times in Scripture. We see John Mark first mentioned in Acts chapter 12, verse 12, and where his mother hosted the prayer meetings. The prayer meetings were held at Mark's mother's house. And of course, we have the story there in Acts chapter 12 of Peter being in jail. And Peter is released by this angel, comes to Mary's house, which is Mark's mother, knocks on a door, and a servant girl named Rhoda answers and says, "Come, Peter's here at the door," and celebrates and forgets to let Peter in. This is that house. This is John Mark's house in Acts chapter 12. And a few verses later there in Acts chapter 12, we see that Mark also accompanies Paul and Barnabas to Antioch. So he leaves his home there in Jerusalem, travels with Paul and with Barnabas, who we find out later on is Mark's cousin. So John and Barnabas are cousins. And so they go up to Antioch. The next chapter talks about how Paul and Barnabas decide to go on a missionary journey, what we call the first missionary journey of Paul and Barnabas, and Mark goes with them. Mark starts out this journey with them. He travels with them to the island of Cyprus. And now they travel throughout the island of Cyprus and get to the end of the Cyprus and meet up with the synagogues there, and also confronts Emmaus, the sorcerer, there. And Emmaus goes blind, and that whole story there in chapter 13 of Acts. But then we read something strange about Mark in Acts 13:13. He goes part way in the missionary journey, but then part way through, he returns to Jerusalem. Part way through this missionary journey, he leaves Paul and Barnabas to go back to Jerusalem. And we're not told there why. We're just told that Mark leaves. And in fact, the word leaves there is just a typical word for leaving. It's not anything significant or theological about it. He just left. And so it's kind of a neutral term there. And so we're left wondering what happened to Mark. What happened to John Mark here? Many of us expect that many have thought about this and thought, well, why did he leave? So there's many reasons why. Maybe he became homesick. He was a young man after all, and maybe he just became homesick and wanted to go back to his mother there in Jerusalem. Maybe he got sick. We're not told, but in Galatians, it says Paul came to the Galatian island or Galatian part of the world and was sick himself. And he came with sickness and some kind of disease of Paul. So maybe Mark also was sick as well. Or maybe he got that fear of, hey, Paul here is going to be sick. I don't want to catch what he has, so he leaves. So maybe he was afraid of getting sick. But then maybe people also have speculated that the road that goes up from the coast there in Galatia is a very rough road, a very dangerous road, one of the most dangerous in the world at that time. And so maybe he just got scared of hey, I'm not sure if I can make it up that road. Maybe he was scared that, hey, they were going to the Gentiles. And that might be a problem too. He might have thought, well, I'm a Jew and going to the Gentiles and didn't like that idea. But I think at this point in Paul's ministry, he wasn't focusing on Gentiles quite yet. He was still going to synagogues. We also see there in verse 13 that Paul starts to take the lead in some certain things. Instead of being referred to as Barnabas and Saul, it's now Paul and Barnabas. The names have been reversed. And so maybe he had hard feelings that his cousin was being second-winded. Oh, I don't know. However, maybe the next time we see Paul's or Mark's name here in the Gospels or in the Bible gives us a little bit different light, because in a few chapters later, in Acts 15, we see Mark's name again, but this is an objection of Paul. You see, Paul wants to go on to a missionary journey again, and Barnabas says, hey, let's take Mark with us. And Paul objects to taking Mark on the second missionary journey. And here, the words are a little bit different. It's not just Paul left us. It's Paul or Mark left us. Mark betrayed us. It's almost a word that kind of hints that Mark might have lost faith. It's actually the word apostasy, which is used in other places about losing your faith and turning back from the Lord Jesus. It was employed in military context to of speaking and withdrawing when you're defeated. You withdraw after you were defeated. Or retreating under fire. So Mark somehow retreated under fire, it seems like. And to use our modern military terms, Mark went AWOL, absent without leave. So this conflict over Mark is what caused Paul and Barnabas to split off from each other. Paul didn't want to take Mark, but Barnabas says, I want to take Mark, my cousin with us. And so Mark and Barnabas go off to the missionary field in Cyprus, while Paul goes off to Galatia with another new person, Silas. And again, we're not told the reason why, but apparently this reason why Mark left was important enough to Paul that he decided to go elsewhere. And that's the last we hear about John Mark in the book of Acts. And if that was it, if that was all we knew of John Mark, we might have a bitter taste in our mouth. Why would this guy who abandoned his faith, maybe to some point, write the gospel? But Mark's names appear in another place in our Bibles, very surprising place, in the letters of Paul. You see, Paul, about 12 years later, writes to a man named Philemon and also to the Colossians, and puts Mark's name at the end. He says, Mark sends his greetings. He's with me. And so we see he's mentioned at the end of Colossians and at the end of Philemon. Mark is with me. In fact, let me read you here what it says from Colossians chapter 4, verse 10. It says, my fellow prisoner, Aristarchus, sends his greeting, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. Now, note what it says there in parentheses. You have received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him. Very interesting how Paul says, hey, you've heard about this Mark guy. Welcome him. There's something about Mark now that's changed. Some kind of reconciliation has been taking place. In fact, at the end of Paul's life, at 2 Timothy, he's mentioned again. Mark is mentioned again. It says there, only Luke is with me. So he's writing to Timothy, get Mark and bring him with you when you come visit me, because he is helpful to me in my ministry. So not only is just Mark reconciled, now he's helpful to Paul. And Paul wants Timothy to bring Mark with him when he comes visits. And this word helpful is used only two other places in the Bible, in the New Testament. The first is used of a man named Onesimus, who was the slave to Philemon. And so when Paul wrote to Philemon, he wrote about Onesimus. Onesimus was a runaway slave who met up with Paul in Rome, was converted, and Paul was sending him back to his master, Philemon. And it says there in Philemon, verse 11, about Onesimus, formerly he was useless to you, but now he has become helpful or useful to you and to me. And so he's writing to Philemon, who a few verses later will say, by the way, Mark is with me, thinking about Onesimus and how helpful he is now. It's also in 2 Timothy, this word. Again, a book where at the end here, just a few chapters later, we'll talk about Mark. It says, in a large house, there are articles not only of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay. Some of these are used for noble purposes and some for ignoble or not very noble purposes. If a man cleanses himself of the latter, the ignoble purposes, he will be an instrument for noble purposes, made holy and useful to the master and prepared for any good work. Now, when Paul wrote these things with Mark's name at these two books with Mark's name at the end, I don't think he was just talking to Timothy or talking to Philemon. I think in his mind he was thinking, Mark. I'm thinking about how Mark was useful to me. How Onesimus was useful, is now useful to Philemon. How these instruments that were formerly not very noble things are now cleansed and made noble. You see, Mark had changed. And I think Paul was thinking about Mark as he wrote these words, how useful Mark now was to him. Apparently, in his eyes, Mark has cleansed himself from ignoble purposes, things that were not very good, things, mistakes in his life, and became an instrument, noble, worthy, and prepared to do any good work. He had turned his life around. And so I think this gives us a new insight on the book of Mark and how we can look at Mark's gospel, because he was useful to Paul. But apparently about this time also, according to church history, Mark also met back up with Peter. Now, Peter was a leader there in the Jerusalem church, and Mark had grown up in a Jerusalem church. But he meets back up with Peter because, according to church tradition, the gospel of Mark was written with Peter's help. That Mark was hearing Peter, the apostle Peter, preaching, and decided to write Peter's words down, his sermons, into a gospel. Even at the end of Peter, in his book that Peter writes, his letter that he writes, 1 Peter, Mark is mentioned as being with him there in Babylon, which is code for Rome. That Mark was there with Peter and Paul there in Rome about the time that they were martyred. So about 60-65 AD, Paul and Peter were both in Rome under prison arrest, about to be killed by Nero, and Mark was with them. And by all accounts, shortly after Peter died, after he was killed, Mark decided to compose a gospel, which is entitled by his name, Mark. So let's look at the gospel of Mark now. We looked at the person of Mark. Let's look at the gospel of Mark. Even though Matthew is first in the New Testament, the first gospel, most likely Mark was written first. Mark was probably written before all the other gospels. It's probably the first gospel put together. Because according to scholars, Matthew and also later Luke would use Mark's words and Mark's structure as kind of a basis for their own gospels. And so that's why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are all very similar, because they kind of borrowed from each other. They see through the same eyes, synoptic, They're called synoptic gospels. It means through the same eyes. So Matthew and Luke probably use Mark and probably some other materials that they have gathered to write their gospels, but Mark was first. And there are several characteristics that we will see as we start to study the book of Mark. Well, first of all, we'll see that Luke will use Mark's structure and order, but also that Mark is a simple, succinct, and vivid account of the life of Jesus. It's packed with action. It goes from one scene to another with very little in between. It has the least amount of Jesus' teachings, his parables. In fact, we'll only see about 9 parables in contrast to what Matthew wrote, which is 24 parables, and Luke wrote 28 parables. So a lot less parables in the book of Mark. But instead, he focuses on what Jesus did, his actions. It's a very action-packed book. And he keeps it very active by putting his stories together with the words immediately or straight away or at once. You know, at once, right after this, right after that, Jesus did this. And it kind of harkens back again to my introduction about James Bond and how he was a man of action and how he wanted to keep going. But also, Mark is kind of unique in that he has, we'll see many times, a messianic secret. Jesus will say several times to people that he heals or to people he touches and ministers to, don't tell people about me. Don't tell what just happened to you. And we think, well, that's kind of strange. Jesus wants to tell people who he is and what he's all about. And other gospels do mention Jesus telling people not to spread the news of his stories and his miracles, but Mark kind of puts it pretty bluntly. In fact, Mark, because the way Mark is written, he puts all his stories about Jesus telling his messianic secrets or saying, don't tell people about me, right up front in the first 9 chapters. So it seems more frequent. 8 times in 9 chapters, it seems like kind of strange that Jesus says, don't tell anybody about me. And I think there are several reasons why that this happens, why Jesus tells people that not to tell people about me or my miracles or who I am. I think, first of all, Jesus did not want to be viewed just as a miracle worker. I mean, there were several of those who claimed to be miracle workers in those days. And Jesus did not want to be just thought of that. But I also think he did not want his teaching to be hindered. He did not want his ministry to be upset by people coming at all times, all day, times of day and night. We'll even see this as we look at chapter 1. He did not want people demanding healing. He had other task in hand. He did not want too much publicity that would bring about more condemnation by the Pharisees too. You know, he didn't want his death to come prematurely. You see, if he would have racked up all these things against the Pharisees, if the Pharisees would have been more incensed, then he might have been prematurely put to death. And so we'll talk about the messianic secrets as we come across them in various sermons here as we look through Mark. So that's Mark's gospel in a nutshell. So let's jump into Mark chapter 1 and see what it is. And needless to say, even though Mark is the shortest of gospels in terms of chapters, like I said, Mark is packed with messages. In fact, someone called me this last week and says, I knew you were preaching on Mark. So I looked at Mark and, man, even in that first chapter, there's a lot of things going on. And I said, yes. And I'm going to try to pack 16 chapters of Mark in the 12 weeks. Well, actually, 11 and a half weeks. So we already started, I've already wasted half of a sermon this week. So we're not going to read the entire section of Mark when I get to Mark. I'm not going to read the entire chapter 1, but I give you a homework assignment, okay? I know you don't like these homework assignments sometimes, but I'm going to preach on Mark chapter 1 today or this next week as you go home. Read through the entire chapter of Mark. Chapter 1, and see what comes to you. I mean, I'm going to touch on various things, but I'm not going to read it all the way through, and next week I'm going to do 2 and 3, so it's 2 chapters next week. Anyways, so that's your homework assignment, is every week is to read through that section that I'm preaching on, because I'm not going to be able to touch on everything in that section, and I'll tell you what, I'll even give you a bonus, extra credit, okay? Am I a good teacher or what? giving extra credit if you come across something that you read through Mark chapter 1 this last next week. If you come across something that you don't understand or something that you would say, hey, I've learned this from chapter 1, email me or text me or call me on the phone, you'll get extra credit. How about that? I might even let you sit in the front pews next Sunday after that. Would that be something special? Well, Mark starts his chapter out right away, right in the middle of the action. He does not start like Matthew does with a list of genealogical people, so-and-so beget so-and-so beget so-and-so beget. Not like Matthew. Luke, he didn't start like Luke where he talks about the extended birth account where all the Zacharias and the Marys and the angels and the shepherds. No, he doesn't even start off like John does, where John starts off with a theological text. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was... He doesn't do that. He gets into the action. He goes right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, right where he comes down to earth and is baptized by John the Baptist. John the Baptist, talks about verse 1, talks about how Jesus comes down and is baptized and how Jesus goes off into temptation. Boom, bang, bing, right there. Three different little things in the first 13 verses that we can learn, but I'm going to not touch on those this morning. He goes right to the beginning, John's baptism, being tempted for 40 days. And finally in verse 14, we see where Mark is at, and time-wise. After John was put to death, put in prison, Jesus went off to his ministry, verse 14. By the time Matthew got here, it was 4 chapters. Mark does it in 13 verses. Luke, again, 4 chapters it takes for him to get to this point. But Mark, like I said, gets right to the point. And if this is, as the ancient church fathers and ancient church history tells us, that if this is Peter's teachings and Peter's sermons in written form, then you can kind of understand this as well, because Peter was one of those guys that liked to keep you moving too. He was an impulsive type of guy, you know. If you've learned about Peter in the past, how he would jump right in and say, oh, I got the answer, or I can do this. I can protect you, Jesus, cutting off the ear of the servant. And all. Peter was just impetuous. And so it's kind of interesting that this book that's based on Peter's sermons would have this impulsiveness as well. And if you can kind of Peter. It's also kind of interesting when Mark starts introducing the disciples there in chapter 1. He refers to Peter as Simon for the first couple chapters in the book. Simon was Peter's name, this man of action. But we see there in the next 7 verses that Jesus calls his first 4 disciples, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, very quickly. 7 verses, and that's done. Not expanded about like in the other Gospels. But we're going to start reading this morning at the 21st verse and see the kind of action that's characteristics through the rest of the gospel. Because you'll see in this section, starting in verse 21, a day in the life of Jesus. And you'll see how action-packed it is. So if you have your Bibles, open to Mark chapter 1. If not, you can read it off the screen. Mark chapter 1, verse 21. And this is what it says. They, the disciples, went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went to the synagogue and began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an evil spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," said Jesus sternly. "Come out of him." Again, the first type of thing is be quiet, that first messianic secret. The evil spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. The people were so amazed that they asked each other, "What is this, a new teaching? And with authority? He even gives orders to evil spirits, and they obey him." News about him spread quickly over the whole region of Galilee. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening, still on the same day, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Very early the next morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. This is why I've come." You see here, a day in the life of Jesus. And I'm not sure if this is a typical day. I'm not sure if Mark kind of joined these all together just to put his action into the gospel. But it could have been a typical day for Jesus. It seems like this is what Jesus is called to do. That Jesus was not just here to sit around and do nothing. He was there to do this over and over again. But that's the action that took place in this 24 hours or so. Now let's kind of unpack this. You see, first of all, Jesus goes to a synagogue and starts teaching. He taught in these synagogues and talked to them about who the Messiah was. And if other gospels indicate what he might have taught them on, it was Isaiah 61, to talk about preaching the good news and healing the sight, and proclaiming God's favor. But of course, that one that we read about in Luke talks about the one in Nazareth, and this is in Capernaum, so we're not sure if that's exactly what Jesus taught here, but very similar, I'm sure. And he started to show people about what the work of the Messiah was to be, what was to be promised from the Old Testament. And it says he spoke with authority, not like the other teachers of the law. The other teachers would say, "Well, so-and-so, this rabbi before me, says this about the scripture." Relied on hearsay or what previous rabbis said. But no, Jesus talks on his own authority. He says, "Thus says the Lord." This is what the word means, not what I think this means because of someone else. But this is what the word of the Lord means. And then, to top it off, while he's still teaching there, a demon shows up. In the middle of the worship service was a man. Notice, he was a member of the synagogue, if you read the passage there, and was possessed. He spoke up. Says, "How long are you going to torment us? We know who you are." Now, I'm not sure how I would respond if someone in this congregation would suddenly stand up with a demon and says, "Hey, you're preaching God." I'm not sure how I'd react. I know how Jesus reacted. That he just said, "Hey, be gone." And I'm not sure how long this person had infiltrated the worship service there. We're not told how long. He could have been a member for some time. But Jesus firmly and quickly takes control over this situation, literally. He quiets the demon and with authority casts it out. And now the people who are filled with wonder over his teachings were filled with terrifying awe over this man who was possessed and Jesus' authority. And of course, that afternoon, the gossip train in that church went wild, it says. Because Jesus then, that afternoon, goes to Simon's mother-in-law and heals her. Takes time off on that Sabbath afternoon, enjoys himself with the four disciples and Simon's mother-in-law. Hopefully he gets a little rest, because what we see next is at the evening, all these people come to him. All these people from the town who had heard about this teaching in the synagogue that morning, now that it was after the Sabbath, at the evening, at sunset, they can now come. It's kind of interesting. As I thought about it, I thought, wait a second. This was on the Sabbath that Jesus healed Simon's mother-in-law. And how we'll see, in especially the next chapter as we look at it, how the Pharisees get so uptight about healing and teaching on the healing on the Sabbath. And how Mark's gospel, the first miracle mentioned, a healing on the Sabbath. It's kind of ironic that We'll see this next week when he teaches on the Sabbath as well. But it says that after the Sabbath is over, the people come to him. They surround him. And we're not told how late Jesus stays up healing people. I can imagine it's up to wee hours of the morning, because it sounded like there's a lot of people in that town that wanted healing. They had heard about Jesus casting out this demon before and says, hey, we know other people who are demons that need to be cast out. So I'm not sure if Jesus got a nap that afternoon or not, but he stayed up late that night. Because if he didn't get a good nap, I know that me personally, after preaching on Sunday morning, I get kind of weary. You wouldn't think it'd be very hard just to stand up and preach, but it takes a lot out of you. At least it takes a lot out of me. And so I don't know how Jesus felt after teaching in the synagogue and then staying up late that night. We'll see, I don't even know if he felt that power go out of him. We see in Mark chapter 5 in verse 30 that a woman touches him at the hem of his robe and he says, who touched me? He felt the power go out of him, so he must have sensed some kind of power drain. But he had been working all day and late into the night. And yet, the very next morning, it says he gets up very early, before it's light, it says, and starts praying. He went to a solitary place. Maybe it had been quite a jaunt, because Capernaum was a pretty big city in that time, quite a big town. So he spends the time in prayer. And you know what? I think this is where Jesus got his energy from, got that refreshing. He was drained and said, hey, I need to go be with my Father. I need to go away from everyone else to a solitary place and pray. And we'll see this is a good lesson, as we'll see in a minute. But he gets up, spends time with his Father. And it kind of reminds me of what it says in Isaiah 50, verse 4. It says this, the sovereign Lord has given me an instructive tongue to know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me in the morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. And this is kind of the messianic theme. This is a messianic prophecy that he wakens me morning by morning to listen to my Father, to know the word that sustains the weary. And in all likelihood, I think Jesus repeated this same day after day, that every morning he got up and he was refreshed. He preached in the synagogues, he healed people, he spent time with God. And that's what we're called to do too. Because I know that we can learn these three lessons from this day that we see in the life of Jesus, this lessons that we can apply to our lives every day. Because this was the life of Jesus. This is a day in the life of Jesus. Synagogue, demons, healing, praying. So let's learn three daily lessons real quick here before I close this morning. Three daily lessons that we can take with us in our everyday life. The first lesson is to do what God has called you to do every day. Every day, do what God has called you every day. That's what God had given Jesus to do. Jesus' task was to minister to people, to do what God has called him to do. You see, we're not promised tomorrow. We're not promised the next day. We are promised today. And because God has given us this day, it means he has some work for us to do. On the TV this last week or several weeks now have been commercials about this live event coming to the TV about Rent. It's the Broadway show Rent. And one of the songs is a song, 525,600 minutes. 525,600 minutes. This is how many minutes you have in a year. You all have 525,600 minutes, if you calculate it out, every year. How are we spending those minutes? Minutes. Minutes. And see, already we've lost 28,000 already of them. It's already the 20th of January. 28,000 minutes have already passed us by, or I guess it's 28,000 and 10 minutes, I guess it is. But yes, 28,000 minutes have already passed us by. We only got less than 500,000 left in this year. What has God called you to do every day of those days, in those minutes in the year? How are you going to spend those minutes? Is it going to be focused on what God has called you to do? But the second lesson we can learn is to bring health and healing to those who cross your path. Now, we're not miracle workers like Jesus. We cannot heal the sick. We don't lay hands on them and raise them up like Jesus did. I'm not asking you to perform miracles or to cast out demons. But sometimes health and healing come in different ways. It comes with a word of encouragement. It comes with a word of thankfulness to someone else. That will bring healing to their soul. Maybe it's praying for God to do a miracle in someone else's life. That brings health and healing. Just your prayers in your own prayer life. Maybe it's sitting with someone who needs a listening ear and hearing their concerns. That can bring health and healing. Maybe it's a quick text to let someone know that you're thinking of them. You see, bringing health and healing doesn't mean you take away the sickness, but that you are with them in their sickness, in them with their hurts and their pains, physical, emotional, spiritual, whatever. And the greatest sickness out there is a spiritual sickness about those who do not know Jesus. They're sick. They're dying. And so our daily lesson is to do what God has told us to do, but to bring health and healing for those that cross our path. And finally, take time to be with God. Get away, if possible, to a solitary place to be with God. And it doesn't have to be in the morning like Jesus did on this recorded occasion. I'm sure Jesus did at other times of his life and his ministry, took time to be with God. But we all need to take time to recharge our batteries. A time when God can minister to us, when we can hear from him, when we can receive the word that sustains the weary. A time to allow our ears to listen like one being taught. And so as we look at this first chapter here, how Jesus came. He came to do God's will. And we need to do what God calls us to do. Jesus came to heal those around him. We are called to bring health and healing to those who cross our path. And Jesus took time to be with God. So let's apply these things to our lives as we take time with God this week.